with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo de Landeros Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newland, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we'll be having a live interview with the real estate professional building community and their proposal for a real estate transfer fee to support low-income housing projects in Oregon. There could be as many as 11 million Americans who don't know enough English to perform everyday tasks, according to a new federal study. And the European Union has put pressure on the U.S. to come clean about secret alleged CIA activities in Europe by launching an investigation.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq as of today, there have been 2,152 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 42,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports 30,892 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 15th, 2005. I'm Elliot Neal.
And I'm Marlise Franklin. Most of the Hurricane Katrina evacuees who sought help from Multnomah County and the city of Portland have found homes. But for those still in hotels, today is the deadline for getting rent assistance from the city and the county. Officials say the plan to close the Welcome Center at the old Washington Monroe High School today had changed. The center will remain open at least until December 29th to help evacuees with utility bills and furnishings for their new homes. About 65 evacuees sought help at the center yesterday. Workers at the center have case files on about 300 households. Another 300 households may have come to Portland after Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, but found housing on their own or moved back to the Gulf Coast. Elliot?
Oregon will seek permission from the U.S. Department of Education to be one of the 10 states allowed to measure student progress by tracking student test scores over time. State School Superintendent Susan Castillo announced it officially today, and Oregon educators have long been among the loudest protesters of the current system. It asks states to compare the reading and math test scores of different groups of kids from one year to the next, and that would fulfill the mandates of No Child Left Behind, President Bush's signature education law. Last month, Chief Policy Officer Pat Burke told the Associated Press that the state was planning to apply for the increased flexibility. Castillo says measuring growth will allow for more accurate judgment about the success of Oregon schools.
A group of progressive realtors today called for a new program to fund affordable housing programs. The group Real Estate Professionals Building Community is promoting a real estate transfer fee on the sale of homes. They say this kind of fee is already assessed in 37 states, and the money used to address the needs of working families, seniors, and people with disabilities. Live on the phone to talk about this idea is Michael Anderson of the Portland Community Development Network. Michael, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Great. Thanks for being with us.
I'm happy to be with you tonight.
Great. First, tell us why we need a program like this. What kind of problems are people having finding affordable housing?
Well, I think that for all of the listeners out there, they probably, if they aren't experiencing the housing crunch themselves, they know someone on their block or a good friend or a family member. We just saw the headline showing that well over 11,000 students in Oregon's public schools were homeless some period during the last year. Seniors, people with disabilities, hardworking families working low-wage jobs are all just being smashed in a housing market that does not have options that allows them the opportunity and stability that comes with a place to call home.
And how do the real estate transfer fees work in other states?
Well, the real estate transfer fee is a very simple mechanism. When a person sells their house, they give back a small percentage. In Oregon, what we're talking about is 0.5 of a percentile. In Clark County, Washington, they do three times that amount, 1.58%. And they take that money. In Oregon, we would take it and use it for housing. In Washington, they use it for general fund. But there's examples around the country, be it Florida, Illinois, where they use this dedicated source of funding to use the strength of the market to help create housing opportunity for all residents.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of response have you had to this idea?
This has been an idea that housing advocates have been pursuing for well over a decade in Oregon. What's a recent change that's very exciting is that there's a group of realtors who have come forward to take on the main opposition to a real estate transfer fee in Oregon, which is the Realty Association.
Mm-hmm.
And these realtors have said, you know, a Realty Association doesn't speak for all of us professionals. Some of us believe opening opportunity to new first-time home buyers, making sure that all members of our community have a stable place to call home, really should be a priority, and the real estate transfer fee is a way to make it that kind of priority.
Thank you, Michael, for being with us this evening.
Thank you very much.
That was Michael Anderson of the Community Development Network.
Half of the sarin nerve gas rockets at the Umatilla Chemical Depot have been destroyed, reducing the overall storage risk by more than 50%. The faculty has processed nearly 46,000 of the 91,442 GB rockets stored there since it began operation on September 8th of 2004, the Army said. Congress started the chemical weapons disposal program in the 1980s out of concern for the stability of rockets in long-term storage. At the beginning of the incineration program, the facility contained about 12% of the nation's stockpile of chemical weapons, and including rockets, bombs, mines, and artillery shells. The disposals are being done at Umatilla and other storage depots to meet treaty obligations, and they're expected to take several years.
A federal judge says he is likely to boost the amount of water being spilled over Columbia River dams this summer to save salmon. U.S. District Judge James Redden heard arguments over whether the amount of the water spilled over the dam should be increased this summer and spring. Redden did not rule on the request, but says he is leaning toward extending the summer spills by 15 days through to the end of August. Conservation groups and Indian tribes argued the federal government is still not doing enough to improve river flow needed to ensure the survival of young salmon migrating to the sea, but attorneys for the federal government told the judge that several agencies, including the Army Corps of Engineers, are working to solve the problem before 2006. Redden expects to get a report on the situation in January.
The International Forum on Globalization is a California-based group that studies trends in world trade. The group recently issued a report on China's role as a driver of globalization. On the phone with us to talk about that, as well as the new World Trade Organization's ministerial in China, is the IFG's Debbie Barker. Debbie, are you there?
Hello, yes.
Thanks for being with us. Can you give us an overview, Debbie, of the most significant global trade issues on the agenda of the two WTO ministerials this week?
Probably the biggest issue that's causing the most controversy among WTO member nations is actually in agriculture. And that has essentially, those disagreements have essentially stopped, we predict, the WTO ministerial from going forward on the agenda that it wanted to complete at this round. The big issue in agriculture has to do with subsidies, largely that the United States and the EU subsidizes its farmers for certain commodity crops and then transports them or exports them to countries such as India that doesn't have as can't afford to subsidize their farmers as high, and so in effect they're getting grains, and we call it export dumping, where the grains come in from these highly subsidized countries, and they're much cheaper, and it cuts out the domestic farmers. So this is an issue that is caused basically just a huge stalemate in the whole WTO negotiations, and it affects other areas as well, because most of the countries don't want to go forward on other issues such as opening up other areas like investment and things like that until the agriculture situation is really addressed, because it has been so devastating to agriculture farmers and economies and livelihoods around the globe.
And with regards to the International Forum on Globalization, exactly what is it that you do?
I personally am the international director here, and our organization is a research and educational institution. We have what we call associate members. These are leaders and scholars and economists and researchers from civil society movements and research institutes from around the world. So we have a very broad and diverse associate body that gathers together, and we issue publications, we do large public events, we do some internal policy meetings, and we engage with policymakers on different issues.
Well, Debbie, we want to thank you today for being with us here at KBOO. And that was Debbie Barker of the International Forum on Globalization. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Someone stole an illuminated baby Jesus figure from a nativity set in East Medford, but the owner doesn't want to prosecute. Instead, Ralph Patterson wants to offer the rest of the set and a free Bible to the thief. The nativity scene has graced Patterson's yard at the 300 block of Cheritos Avenue for 8 Christmases. This is the first time these figures have been disturbed. The rest of the scene was wrecked also. The Virgin Mary figure was tossed on its side, and the electrical cord and bulb that lit the baby Jesus had been ripped out and left on the ground. Patterson plans to keep the scene unlit from here on. He says it just wouldn't be right to see the other figures growing brightly while the cradle sits empty.
The current time is now 5:12. And now on today's Earthwatch report, how a small community in upstate New York has become a national model of sustainability.
An experimental community in upstate New York sees itself as a model of sustainable living. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. Just outside Ithaca, New York, more than 160 people have formed a unique, close-knit community. It's called an eco-village. 60 households share common grounds, organic gardens, and open space. And they share a common goal, leaving a smaller footprint on the planet. Liz Walker helped found the community in 1991, and she's written a new book about it called Eco Village at Ithaca. She says the idea is to bring back the best of traditional ways of living, similar to towns in early New England or any number of indigenous villages around the world. Walker says the objective is to live at more of a human scale without the alienation of modern society. That sense of community is important to most Eco Village residents. They organize work parties to keep up the common ground, including their 100-acre nature preserve and huge organic gardens. They help each other build and maintain housing. They share resources such as power tools, entertainment centers, and even cars. But it's not a commune. Families own their own homes, have their own incomes, and can keep to themselves as much as they want. But the Eco Village does have its own thriving economy. Many residents work at least part-time as gardeners, child care workers, or craftspeople, and they're efficient. Homes in the village use about 40% less energy than typical households and produce only a quarter of the trash. Walker calls eco-villages the incubators of a new society. She says declining fossil fuels and other resources will force people to find new living arrangements, and eco-villages offer a positive change. There are currently 12 eco-villages in the United States and hundreds more throughout the world. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
The current time is 5:14. Still to come on the KBOO Evening News, the USA Patriot Act is in the U.S. Senate today, where opponents promise a final effort to fight against provisions that limit civil liberties. California's execution of Stanley Tukey Williams has outraged Europeans who regard the practice as barbaric. And Italy has announced that their military contingent in Iraq will be reduced by another 10%. You're listening to Community Radio KBOO in Portland, Vancouver, Corvallis, and Hood River.
The number of elderly prisoners in California is expected to grow to more than 30,000 by the year 2002. The advocacy group Legal 2000 Services for Prisoners with Children recently had completed a study of elderly women in prison. It was found that frail elderly people are subject to the same difficult situations and conditions as prisoners of half their age. The California Report's Judy Campbell has more.
56-year-old Dolores Garcia has recently been released from state prison in Chowchilla. She has a chronic lung condition and says the treatment of her and other frail inmates was overly harsh.
I saw women in their 60s and 70s having to be out in the yard hoeing weeds, running lawn mowers in 100-degree plus weather.
The authors of the report surveyed about a third of the more than 350 elderly women incarcerated in California prisons. Co-author Donna Wilmont says nearly half reported being injured during routine daily activities. She says there's little consideration of older people's special needs.
Women in Chowchilla are housed 8 to a cell. Now, can you imagine being 75 years old, living in a cell with 7 other women and sometimes being assigned to a top bunk and not having handrails in the bathroom? Prisons are really not an environment that's designed for older people.
Wilmont says about half the women surveyed had a dangerous fall in the past year. Her report calls for special geriatric status, allowing inmates to retire from prison work or reduce hours, for example. Terry Thornton with the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation says generally the department agrees with the recommendations, though she says she hasn't heard of elderly women doing hard labor. She says policy changes will be in the governor's January budget.
We're looking at how we house all of our offenders, what their needs are. Are they older, in fact? Do they need to be in a lower bunk as opposed to an upper bunk?
The report also recommends early release for geriatric offenders and changes to mandatory minimum laws that have fueled the boom in the population of the elderly incarcerated. For the California Report, I'm Judy Campbell.
Diabetes is on the rise in California, and its minorities are the hardest hit, according to a new UCLA health survey. Health experts are especially worried about how the disease is affecting young people. The California Report's Deborah Baer.
The study shows that the number of California adults diagnosed with diabetes rose to nearly 1.7 million in 2003, an increase of 300,000 people from 2001. African Americans and American Indians are still the most likely to have the disease, but the study found a significant rise in diabetes among Latinos between the ages of 50 and 64. The survey of over 40,000 California residents also confirms a troubling trend in diabetes among young people. UCLA Assistant Professor Allison Diamant, an MD, authored the study. She says 27,000 adolescents had the disease in 2003, up from 15,000 in 2001.
This is worrisome. Diabetes has predominantly been a condition of older people, and I'm talking mainly about type 2 diabetes, where obesity is the major risk factor for it.
A healthy diet and increased physical activity can reduce the risk for diabetes. Dr. Ann Albright, chief of the State Department of Health Services Diabetes Program, says the report confirms that the disease, which has been rising significantly for a decade, is a growing epidemic.
We are trying to bring partners together from around the state. We're trying to make sure people have easier access to programs and resources that are out there and available to use. Part of our challenge is that we have very limited funding. We actually have no state funding in this program.
The California Diabetes Program has established a resource website at caldiabetes.org. For the California Report, I'm Deborah Baer in Los Angeles.
The Conservative American Family Association said Thursday it will consider reinstating a boycott against Ford Motor Company because the automaker plans to continue running advertisements in gay publications. Ford said last week it planned to stop advertising its Jaguar and Land Rover luxury brands in gay publications to reduce its marketing costs. But after gay rights groups complained and held meetings with the automaker, Ford then reversed course and said Wednesday it would continue to advertise all of its 8 brands in gay publications. The AFA originally called for a boycott against Ford last spring, but suspended it for 6 months at the request of a group of Ford dealers.
Nobody's saying if the new levees in New Orleans will hold up under a Category 5 storm, but the federal government is promising to make them stronger and better. President Bush will be asking for another $1.5 billion to rebuild the levee system. The plan involves reinforcing the levees with stone and concrete, installing new pumps, and closing some canal sections. The main point, Bush's point man on rebuilding, Donald Powell, says the new levees will protect the city from any hurricane as strong as Hurricane Katrina.
A modified USA Patriot Act is in the U.S. Senate today after being approved by the House on Wednesday. Senate opponents promised a last-ditch fight against provisions they say limit civil liberties. KBOO's Mistletoe Angel reports.
Today is Bill of Rights Day, marking the 214th anniversary of the ratification of the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution. And critics of the USA Patriot Act say the timing is ironic since Congress is voting this week on renewing and expanding that controversial federal law. A bipartisan coalition of senators is working to delay the vote and are threatening a filibuster. David Fedonke with the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon says that's in the best interest of Americans.
It's essential that Congress take more time to gather more information about how these powers have been used so that real reform can have a chance of passing Congress.
Fedonke says recent reports indicate the FBI has issued 30,000 national security letters in the past year looking for information on millions of Americans.
All of this has been done under a cloak of secrecy that even Congress has not gotten the facts on. And it's outrageous that Congress would be voting to expand the Patriot Act powers at a very time when they don't have information about how these powers have been used.
The administration says if the provisions are allowed to expire at the end of the year, it will put the nation's safety in jeopardy. But critics suggest the current provisions could be renewed for 90 days to allow greater safeguards for civil liberties to be added to the bill. Content was provided by the Oregon News Service. I'm Mistletoe Angel, KBOO News.
The White House agreed today to accept Senator John McCain's amendment to ban torture of detainees held by U.S. forces. Darby Hickey reports from Washington, D.C.
The Bush administration has been resisting the Senate-approved anti-torture amendment proposed by Senator John McCain. Calling for an exemption from the rule for CIA interrogators, the president was dealt a blow yesterday when the House overwhelmingly passed a non-binding measure in support of the McCain amendment. Now, a compromise has been reached, which Senator McCain and President Bush announced this afternoon at the White House.
Now we can move forward and make sure that the whole world knows that, as the President has stated many times, that we do not practice cruel, inhuman treatment or torture. This agreement basically does two things. One, puts into the Army Field Manual the specific procedures for interrogations. And two, it prohibits cruel, inhumane or torture.
Another opponent of the anti-torture amendment, the Republican chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, Duncan Hunter, has yet to indicate his position on the compromise. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey in Washington, D.C.
The Senate is poised to approve a measure that would require the Bush administration to provide Congress with its most specific and extensive accounting about the secret prison system established by the CIA to house terrorism suspects. The measure includes amendments that would require the Director of National Intelligence to provide regular detailed updates about secret detention facilities maintained by the U.S. overseas and to account for the treatment and condition of each prisoner. The Bush administration has never officially acknowledged that secret detention facilities exist, but the basic facts surrounding them have been described by current and former government officials. An agreement reached yesterday between Democrats and Republicans called for the measure to be approved by unanimous consent, but it was unclear when a final vote might occur.
California's execution of Stanley Tookie Williams on Tuesday outraged many in Europe who regard the practice as barbaric, and politicians in Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's native Austria called for his name to be removed from a sports stadium in his hometown. At the Vatican, Pope Benedict XVI's top official for justice matters denounced the death penalty for going against redemption and human dignity. Capital punishment is illegal throughout the European Union, and many Europeans consider state-sponsored executions to be barbaric. Such opinions were amplified in the case of Williams due to the apparent remorse they believe the Crips gang co-founder showed by writing children's books about the dangers of gangs and violence. Williams was executed early Tuesday at California's San Quentin State Prison after Schwarzenegger denied Williams' request for clemency. Schwarzenegger suggested that Williams' supposed change of heart was not genuine because he had not shown any real remorse for the killings committed by the Crips.
California's three-year-old law allowing some illegal immigrants to pay in-state college tuition is being challenged in court. A group of students and parents filed suit in Yolo County on Wednesday against the UC, CSU, and community college systems. The suit accuses the state of violating federal law. The California Report's John Myers has more.
The key question in the lawsuit filed on Wednesday is someone who is not in the United States legally cannot receive a break on state college tuition unless that same break is given to everyone, including U.S. citizens who live in a different state. With that in mind, 42 students and parents who have paid out-of-state tuition at UC, CSU, and community college campuses have now filed a lawsuit to get some of their money back.
The law in California discriminates against out-of-state U.S. citizens and in favor of, you might say, out-of-state illegal aliens.
Chris Kobach is an attorney working on behalf of the lawsuit.
These students are essentially suing to protect their right to be treated no worse, not to be treated better, but just to be treated no worse than an illegal alien who's present in the United States.
But representatives of the state's higher education institutions say the 2002 law isn't about citizenship, it's about residency. They say illegal immigrants are only eligible for in-state tuition if they attend high school in California for 3 years and if they sign an affidavit saying they intend to apply for legal status. UC spokesperson Ravi Poor says out of 208,000 students in the UC system, only about 1,300 got the tuition break last year. And most of those students were U.S. citizens with special circumstances.
For example, a student who went to school in California their whole life, and the family, you know, decides to move to Colorado after the student graduates from high school. You know, technically their legal residence is where their parents moved.
Still, a successful lawsuit could prove to be a financial headache for state government. The plaintiffs say some 60,000 students have been unfairly charged tuition under the law. That could result in tens of millions of dollars, money the state has likely already spent. For the California Report, I'm John Myers in Sacramento.
There could be 11 million adults in the U.S. who don't know enough English to perform everyday tasks. A federal study estimates that's how many adults are not literate in English. The study finds that over the past decade or so, the nation's adults haven't made any progress in their ability to read a newspaper or a book. They also showed no improvement in understanding documents like bus schedules or prescription labels. It's not just the uneducated who aren't making gains in literacy. The Education Department study finds that in every level of education, from high school dropouts to people with graduate degrees, adult literacy either declined or held steady. The nation's adults did make some gains in dealing with numbers, such as calculations on a tax form or a bank statement, but even there, the typical adult shows only basic skills. On each type of task, black adults made gains. Hispanics, though, showed sharp declines in their ability to handle documents and prose.
Former newspaper mogul Conrad Black was indicted by federal prosecutors Thursday on additional charges that include racketeering and obstruction of justice. The new charges came 2 weeks after Black pleaded not guilty to fraud charges in connection with the alleged looting of more than $80 million from the Hollinger International Incorporated newspaper empire he himself once controlled. The charges were brought in an indictment returned Thursday by a federal grand jury in Chicago and announced by U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald.
The current time is 5:29, and now daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
So, bucko, are you still whining that Congress is unresponsive? That your Congress critter won't even answer your letters, much less take your phone calls? Well, sit up and take notice of the inspiring example of one citizen who sent out a call for help and got 33 lawmakers to spring into action on his behalf. I'm talking about Jack Abramoff, a fellow much like you and me. Except that he's a multi-million dollar lobbyist with tight ties to the Bushites, Tom DeLay, and other top Republican leaders. Hear this man's story, though, and learn a lesson in civics. It seems that Jack represented two Indian tribes in Louisiana and Mississippi that ran profitable gambling casinos on their tribal land. But suddenly, a third tribe entered the picture, asking the Interior Department to okay another casino on their land, which would cut into the profits of the first two tribes. Like any American citizen, Jack appealed to Congress for help, and he was delighted to find that all 33 members he approached responded with alacrity. All 33 promptly wrote letters to the Interior Secretary asking that the third tribe have its casino rejected. Here's the lesson for us. Jack Abramoff put a little sweetener in his request for congressional help. Either his lobbying firm or his clients donated more than $830,000 to the 33 Congress critters within days of their intervention on his behalf. House Speaker Dennis Hastert, for example, received $21,500 in Abramoff money and only 7 days later wrote his letter to the Interior Secretary. In all, Hastert pocketed $103,000 from Jack and his two casino clients. Also, Democratic leader Harry Reid sent his letter off, and amazingly, the very next day, one of Jack's tribal clients issued a check to Reid's political fund. This is Jim Hightower saying, so see, Bucko, if you want Congress to be responsive to your needs, it's all in the way you ask. Support for this program comes from the Progressive Magazine, featuring columnists Molly Ivins, Howard Zinn, and Barbara Ehrenreich, with features and information available at progressive.org.
Stay tuned for independent Native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m., hear Proverbial Perspectives. At 7, it's Good Times with Reggae Bob. Tonight's weather, mostly clear in the evening, then partly cloudy, lows 25 to 30. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs 40 to 45. You're listening to the Cable Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
The European Parliament today ratcheted up pressure on the U.S. administration to come clean about alleged CIA activities in Europe by voting to launch an investigation into claims the intelligence agency used European Union airports to transport terrorist suspects to countries where they could be tortured. In a resolution backed by all the Parliament's main political groups, bar the center-right European People's Party, EU legislators agreed to set up a temporary committee of inquiry that will begin work in January. Its aim will be to find out whether the CIA has been involved in the extraordinary rendition of ghost detainees to third countries without access to legal counsel, and to judge whether alleged terrorists have been subjected to cruel treatment or torture. It will also seek to establish whether such practices are legal on European territory and whether EU governments were involved in the, quote, illegal deprivation of liberty of individuals, end quote. The European Parliament's resolution recalls that Article 7 of the EU Treaty holds out the possibility of suspending a member state's voting rights if it is found to have violated fundamental human rights. Elliot?
Iraqis, including many Sunnis who boycotted last January's election, headed to the polls in record numbers today to vote in the country's parliamentary election. At least one attack was carried out in central Baghdad's Green Zone, which houses the U.S. Embassy. Today was also the third and final day of expatriate voting, and election officials in Amman, Jordan, said turnout was higher than either of the previous 2 days. David Enders has more.
Here in Jordan, such a discussion has a good-natured tone, though earlier in the week a mob in Nasiriya, a poor largely Shiite city in southern Iraq, burned the office of secular candidate Iyad Alawi, after a commentator said during an interview on Al Jazeera that Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, the country's highest-ranking cleric, should not be involved in politics. During a campaign stop in Najaf, one of Shiite Islam's holiest cities last week, Iraqis threw shoes at Alawi, a sign of disrespect in Iraqi culture. Mohammed Fadl said he voted for list number 555, a grouping of religious Shiite candidates. Like many Iraqis, he is still angry at the former U.S.-appointed prime minister for allowing U.S. troops to attack Fallujah and Najaf.
He declared war on Fallujah and Najaf and on Iraq. He didn't do anything right.
Many Sunni voters also said they supported religious candidates. Abu Esra voted for the Iraqi Islamic Party, a list consisting mainly of religious Sunnis.
The last government separated religion and politics, and we got nothing from it. Perhaps now it'll be good for us.
Supporters of different lists accused the other of paying people to vote. The Samir al-Jaf, the head of the polling center, was dismissive.
There have been no complaints. Those are just rumors.
Despite those assertions, Jordanian police had detained more than a dozen young men in the courtyard of the school that was being used as a polling center, saying that the men had been trying to vote for a second time. In Amman, I'm David Enders reporting for FSRN.
Italy's defense minister said their military contingent in Iraq will be reduced by a further 10%, adding that the nation's commitment to Iraq remains unchanged. Italy, which did not take part in the U.S.-led war on Iraq, currently has the fourth largest contingent serving there after the American, British with 8,500, and South Korean with 3,200. After a drop from 3,200 to 2,900 in September, there will be a further reduction to 2,600 in January. Italian Premier Silvio Berlusconi's staunch ally of the U.S. President George W. Bush, has said the troop numbers will gradually be reduced as the situation improves in Iraq. He said last month that Italy expected to withdraw from Iraq at the end of 2006. While the center-left opposition claims the Italian troops in Iraq are involved in what amounts to an ongoing war, the government insists on the humanitarian nature of the mission.
European Union leaders announced today that they were set to condemn Iran's president for denying the Holocaust and warned Tehran the opportunity for a diplomatic solution to its nuclear program. It can't stay open forever. A summit statement drafted by the EU and foreign ministers said of President Mahmoud that the Nazis' mass extermination of Jews was a myth, quote, "These comments are wholly unacceptable and have no place in a civilized political debate," unquote. It has also voiced grave concern at Iran's failure to remove suspicions about its nuclear intentions and said, quote, "The window of opportunity will not remain open indefinitely," unquote. Diplomats said the tough language on Iran was part of a wider EU statement on the Middle East to be issued either tonight or tomorrow.
The former chief of staff of Israel's military has been charged in a U.S. federal court with war crimes and crimes against humanity. Leila El-Haddad has more from Gaza.
The class action lawsuit was filed against retired General Moshe Yaalon in a Washington, D.C. court earlier today for his involvement in the killing and injury of hundreds of civilians in a 1996 bombing of a U.N. compound in southern Lebanon. Over 100 civilians who had sought shelter from the Israeli shelling were killed in the attack, and hundreds of others wounded, including U.N. personnel. The suit was filed on behalf of the sole survivor of a 10-member family, among others. As head of Israeli Army Intelligence at the time, he alone participated in the decision to shell the clearly marked UN compound in Qana and commanded responsibility for the attack, according to the complaint. The suit follows a complaint filed last week against Avi Deichter, Israel's former intelligence chief, for his role in the decision to drop a one-ton bomb on a crowded residential neighborhood in Gaza City in July of 2002. 15 Palestinians were killed and hundreds more injured in the attack. From Gaza City for Free Speech Radio News, this is Leila Haddad.
The World Bank gave India $110 million for the city of Delhi to ensure the management of its water system, and it's handed over to private corporations. FSRN's Vinod K. Jose looks at how the World Bank is pushing its water privatization project while Delhi's residents are resisting it.
New Delhi, Indian capital, is home for 15 million people. The city gets 88% of its water from the river Ganges and Yamuna, both originating from the Himalayas. Slated in the essential services, water has been supplied to its citizens by the government. But lately, city dwellers have become worried at the threat of water privatization. The World Bank came forward with a $110 million plan to hand over the water supply from the government to multinational companies. Arvind Kejriwal is the leader of Parivartan, the civil body union to oppose water privatization.
We found that the entire project is going to be extremely harmful. If it were implemented, it could ruin the water sector in Delhi in the next 2-3 years. And the only one sector which is going to benefit out of this whole project is the water companies. This is an extremely sweet deal that is being offered to the companies at the total expense of the people of Delhi.
The administration says that there is no dearth for water in Delhi. But what they blame is the water practice of the people and advocates for what they call reforms. Anjali Rai is the Vice President of Delhi Water Board.
I must say that all of us must agree that we need to have reforms. We are not able to achieve continuous water supply because of our poor managerial practices.
But residents say reforms is the pleasant word used for privatization. In effect, the government is suggesting that they want to hand over the water sector to multinational companies. While the World Bank says they are here to improve the living standards. Sumir Lal is the Director, External Affairs, World Bank.
The problem really is not unique to Delhi. India's urban water supply and sanitation service is deplorable. By developing country standards, it's pathetic. It is even worse than a lot of African countries, which implies in turn that there is a definite crisis of management and of the basic quality of delivering public services.
The World Bank insisted the Delhi government to appoint PricewaterhouseCoopers as its consultant. PricewaterhouseCoopers was paid $2.5 million and its report advocated water privatization in Delhi. The civil body union accuses the World Bank for not just promoting privatization but also for corruption. Arvind Kejriwal, the leader.
I mean, simple, World Bank is a commercial organization. World Bank is investing. India is a very good destination for investment. They never default on anything and the loan is coming at commercial rate of interest. Why are they promoting privatization, a particular model? Is it because of ideological corruption? Is it because there is any other corruption involved? Because we also have documents which show that in the award of contracts to consultants, World Bank has intervened several times and forced Delhi Jal Board to cancel their bids, redo the bidding until Pricewaterhouse got this contract. So why is World Bank trying to promote Pricewaterhouse?
Moreover, the World Bank promoted a study instructing the government to appoint 4 experts with a monthly salary of $25,000 per month. This is a whopping monthly salary according to third world standards. In the coming months, many will wait to see whether the Delhi administration would succumb to World Bank pressure or listen to its civil society. From New Delhi in India, this is Vinod K. Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
The UN Security Council said in a statement yesterday that the world body would temporarily relocate military and civilian staff from Eritrea to Ethiopia in the interest of safety. Last week, the Eritrea ordered out peacekeepers from the U.S., Canada, and Europe. The decision affects some 180 military observers and civilian logistics staff, but the UN said today that roughly 20 extra staff from other nationalities would also be leaving. The deadline for their departure is tomorrow. The order for peacekeepers to leave within 10 days will stymie the UN operation to monitor the tense Eritrea-Ethiopia border, where the war killed 70,000 people between 1998 and 2000. The Eritrean move was widely viewed as a sign of frustration that the international community has done little to force Ethiopia to implement demarcation of their common border. In a peace deal struck in 2000, the two countries agreed an independent commission would decide on where their border should be, but Ethiopia later rejected the ruling.
Sri Lankan government and Tamil Tiger rebels announced today they are expected to commence peace talks early next year. It's hoped that there could be face-to-face talks with the Liberation Tigers of Tamil early next year or strengthening the troubled truce, the Sri Lankan government and peace facilitators said. The statement followed the Sri Lankan foreign minister talks with the Norwegian counterpart in Hong Kong on the sidelines of the WTO meeting. Sri Lankan's government and the Tamil Tigers have been observing a ceasefire since February of 2002. The U.S. and United Nations called on both sides to maintain the truth after the increase in violence.
The United States yesterday proposed to increase aid for trade funding during the WTO ministerial in Hong Kong. Meanwhile, the African delegates charged that the U.S. and the EU are making empty promises. FSRN's Dante Toza spoke with Tanya Van Mielis of the South African Trade Union Confederation.
What are some of the proposals that the EU and the U.S. is pushing on the African Union?
Well, I think some of the proposals that they're putting forward is that they're saying they're cutting their subsidies dramatically so that there is movement in agriculture because they're cutting their domestic subsidies. And in fact, that's really all smoke and mirrors. In reality, the American subsidies have actually increased over for agriculture. And what they do is they often, in the agricultural negotiations, say we're shifting from the amber box, which is subsidies that are supposed to distort trade, to another box, like a blue box. So it's almost like, you know, the game where you hide something under three cups and you whiz them around. That's what's happening. They're just whizzing the subsidies around into different boxes. The subsidies are still there. You just can't always find them when you're picking up the boxes.
What would be the outcome of this meeting that the African Union is hoped to achieve, and what likely to happen, and what if the talks is getting stalled again?
The best thing would be to achieve a developmental outcome, and probably the key thing for the African Union to develop is to get access into the markets of the North. So that would be first prize. Secondly, to make sure in terms of promoting development that we're not giving away our policy space at home. If there's no movement, I think what it really shows is that the power of developing countries together with civil society has actually increased over the last number of years, and we're in a position where we're able to block trade rules that are going to create further imbalances and further disadvantage. So to some extent, even if there's no agreement, that could be claimed as a partial victory because it means something worse hasn't been imposed on us. But I think that there is an opportunity to still try and achieve a developmental agenda. And it would be a great pity if we missed that opportunity to achieve more development. How it plays out, though, in the next few days really depends on how the coalitions are holding. If the AU, for example, if the G20 holds, if the developing country coalitions generally hold together, then we've got a much better chance.
Dante Toza speaking with Tanya Van Mielis of the South African Trade Union Confederation at the WTO Ministerial Conference in Hong Kong.
Thousands of South Korean farmers marched on the WTO ministerial today, demanding access to the closed talks. They walked up to police barricades as a group, regularly pausing to bow and meditate as a form of Buddhist meditation. FSRN's Aaron Glantz reports.
The South Korean government handed out loans to help farmers make their businesses bigger and more competitive on the world market. But Han says all that did was mire peasants in debt. Han says the cheap rice from China and Thailand and subsidized rice from the United States is driving the price of his product down by 25% each year.
In terms of our livelihoods and the basic, you know, survival, cost of living increases, but our income remains the same, meaning that the debt will continue to increase because we have to borrow money. If not, we won't be able to survive. You know, we'll starve to death. We can't even send our kids to school. So, and I think that these policies of trying to apply competition rules and free trade rules to agriculture, as long as this exists and this is pushed by the WTO, as long as the WTO exists, these policies will continue. We'll be driven even further into poverty.
Han doubts his farm will last another generation. He has a 16-year-old daughter, and she has no desire to work in agriculture.
She's only 16 years old, so she's not fully matured, and she's not an adult yet. Well, I have made an attempt, you know, suggested, when you grow up, would you like to become a farmer like me? But she has emphatically said no.
Why?
The same as the son. Because she has seen for herself that being a farmer can provide her needs. You know, and actually, personally, even for me, I myself don't want my children to continue this family business because that will be like inheriting poverty to my children. It will be a heritage of poverty.
But Han says he's too mired in debt, so he can't sell his farm.
We're trapped. Personally, I'm in the debt
to the order of 107 million won. And so even if I sell my farm and all the land that I own, I won't even be able to pay back the debt.
South Korean farmers plan to demonstrate every day until the WTO concludes on Saturday. They say if they aren't allowed inside the talks before Saturday, they'll use methods that are more confrontational. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in Hong Kong.
At least 12 people have been killed in an overnight shootout in Nepal's Kathmandu Valley, with the army blaming the incident on a lone drunken soldier, while unconvinced human rights activists are demanding tougher gun control measures for security personnel. A 27-year-old soldier posted on the Royal Nepalese Army began firing indiscriminately at a crowd gathered for an annual religious festival, killing 11 civilians and then turning the gun on himself. However, a group of human rights activists who rushed to the massacre site to investigate the shooting said the army had conducted a cover-up operation to hide evidence that other soldiers were also involved. The killings come as the government, headed by King Gyanendra, outright rejected pleas by the international community and rights activists to reciprocate a ceasefire called by the Maoist guerrillas, saying only elections could resolve the 9-year communist insurgency.
Authorities at Japan's Asahiyama Zoo are taking the penguins on a 500-yard walk on the snowy grounds twice a day. The zoo's 15 king penguins aren't exactly obese. However, penguin winter weight does vary from 33 pounds up to 40 pounds, said a zoo official. And so far, only one of the flock is 40 pounds. The reason for weight gain is natural, zoo officials say. And so, to fend off obesity, the zoo instituted the winter exercise program for 2003. The penguins have 10 or web feet and can only walk significant distances on snow, so the program can only take place during the colder months. The zoo on the northern island of Hokkaido takes the penguins on strolls from December through April. The first walk of the season was today. That's the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 15th, 2005. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203. Or you can send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Mistletoe Angel. Tonight's audio editor was Lisa Loving. Special thanks to reporter Stephanie Potter, our engineer Brian Averill, and the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Elliot Neal.
Thank you, Elliot. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, Ani and Melody host Positively Revolting Talk Radio. Topics include the upcoming solstice and visioning the new year. Also, Motion Lakeman will give us an update on the latest projects of the Village Building Convergence. At 9, it's Marlena's Electronic Salon. Host Marlena Smith will speak with Ed Goldberg about politics and culture. At 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Thank you so much for joining us.
This is Independent Native News for Thursday, the 15th of December. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. In Washington State, a ban on smoking in all public places went into effect on December 8th. Voters overwhelmingly passed the smoke-free initiative last month, but as Robin Carnine reports, the new law may be a violation of the American Indian Religious Freedom Act.
Religious freedom for Native Americans includes the practice of smudging with ceremonial smoke off reservations, at indoor powwows, weddings, funerals, and even in sweat lodges. As the smoke-free law now stands, those who use smoke for ceremonial purposes in public buildings and facilities could be legally fined and denied access to these places. This concerns Storm Reyes, a Native American chaplain and member of the Puyallup tribe. After viewing the bill, Reyes immediately contacted the Pierce County Health Department in Tacoma, where she was told a variance process could be initiated for tribes who want to use the Native ceremonial practice of smudging at public events. But this would require a 10-day notice prior to events, and the tribe would have to get a permit and pay a fee. This alarms Reyes, and as a chaplain, she says the variance is no compromise.
I told them that was not going to work simply because one of the things that happens with me is I might get a phone call at midnight to be called to a hospice, and 10 days is not acceptable, and frankly, just the whole concept of having to get a permit to pray was not acceptable.
Reyes worries that the law sets Native American religious practice back at least one generation. 45 years ago, her family and 75 other tribal members were raided by police at a stick game where ceremonial smoke was used. Washington Representative Jeannie Daniel is slated to introduce a bill in the House that would allow statewide exemption to the law for freedom of religion. Reyes says other plaintiffs, including the ACLU, are ready to go forward with a lawsuit against the state of Washington. For Independent Native News, I'm Robin Carnine.
The U.S. Supreme Court has refused to take up an appeal intended to block construction of a private nuclear waste storage site on tribal land in Utah. But as Sandra Harris reports, the site won't be built anytime soon.
The chair and CEO of Private Fuel Storage says the Supreme Court's decision not to intervene won't end challenges to the company building the above-ground repository on tribal land of the Skull Valley Goshute Tribe. John Parkin says a move to establish a wilderness in Utah was recently added to the defense authorization bill. Parkin says it could affect rail service to the site. He says challenges by opponents of the temporary storage site will likely continue.
Assuming we get through this one, and if we don't, then we just have to go a different direction hauling it in anyway, but then there'll be something they'll try again next year. None of the legislation that's come to Congress has ever had an alternative.
Parkin says PFS was started 10 years ago after 8 utilities realized a permanent national facility at Yucca Mountain, Nevada was years away from approval. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission approved a license for PFS in September. A challenge to the decision is pending. Parkin has said in the past the earliest the storage site could be ready is 2008. I'm Sandra Harris.
In Connecticut, the Mashantucket Pequot's Foxwoods Resort Casino has reclaimed its name from a cyber squatter. WSHU's Ebong Udama reports.
The disputed site is www.foxwood.com. That's Foxwood without the S. A Massachusetts man, Ray Redican Jr., had created the domain site. The Mashantucket Pequot's casino site is foxwoods.com with an S. The tribe sued Redican, claiming he registered the domain name in violation of Connecticut's Unfair Trade Practices Act and was trying to confuse Foxwoods casino customers for his own gain. A federal judge in Bridgeport agreed and ruled in favor of the tribe. Redican apparently offered to sell the Mashantucket Pequot the URL for $20 million. But the tribe has consistently refused to pay people who register URLs with variations of its name. In Fairfield, Connecticut, I'm Ebon Udama.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by News from Indian Country's e-edition, online at IndianCountryNews.com. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairfield.